In the last 5 years, he's received 4 Oscar nominations. And I'm willing to bet, I hate to go out on a limb here, but I'm willing to bet this year is going to be 5 out of 6. I think it's safe to say 2 things about this picture. Number one, it's probably going to make the most money of any film in history by a comfortable margin. And number two, there won't be a sequel, as far as I can tell. But, you know, you can never tell.
It might be a prequel.
Okay, well, maybe that. But I think they've kind of examined this subject about as thoroughly as can be examined.
Yeah, I think they have, yes, absolutely. They've even shut down the studios now, so I think they're fine, yeah.
Yeah.
Can move on.
To ask the obvious question, the pressure of having to make the last one the best, and I think it's pretty universally regarded as the best one in the series. I mean, everybody just absolutely did their best. Was the pressure even more unusual than you usually feel? And I know the kind of pressure you put on yourself.
When I did part one, the pressure was huge because I was, for the first time, doing a Harry Potter, which is a huge commitment. And as you know, my respect and love for John Williams' music, it was even more dangerous for me to go in this territory. So I had already a lot of pressure on this one, on this first episode. And so when I was asked to do the last one, the pressure of part one, with this incredible pressure of ending the series and making sure that not only the music was right, you know, in the film, but also that it would speak to the millions of fans and the audience all over the world, because it's a huge, as you said, success, and millions and millions of people will see it and therefore hear the music. So yes, it was a big pressure. It's a lot of work and a lot of fears that you have to go over.
Well, obviously, the composer Alexander Desplat has stopped in this evening. We're going to be playing the entire Harry Potter, The Deathly Hallows Part 2 tonight, and we're just going to talk about whatever we feel like talking about, as per usual. Alexander Desplat, welcome back to KUSC.
I'm so glad to be back,
yes.
Jim. And I'm always glad to be back, because as soon as I arrive in L.A., I go into the car and I've got this rental car, so I have to reselect each time. And of course, the first one I select is 91.5. And I hear your voice right away, and I say, I'm back to LA. And yesterday or the day before, I was hearing a Recorders band that you played, and plays most incredible variety of classic pieces and with always great performances. And there was this William Walton symphony that you played. I couldn't get out of the car. I had to stay.
It's a winner. Yeah,
it's great.
It's
incredible.
Great.
It's great. So I'm really glad to be back.
Yeah. This score, you know, I think gives the lie to the notion. There's this old saw about what film music should do. And rule number one is it should always serve the picture. And of course, you know, that's a sort of the basic requirement for a film score. A great score, which this one certainly is, does so much more. It levitates the thing onto a different level if it really is doing its job. And this one certainly does. I mean, it makes it... when the writer of The Queen was in, and we were talking about that, and he just said spontaneously, you know, the score added $15 million to the movie, to the way it looked. This one did, too. I mean, I think this one added a lot more than that, because there's a lot more to do in this score.
Yes, there's more to do. And you know, this levitation that you mentioned, it's several levels. It's three-dimensional to me. I feel it when I write the music of a scene or a sequence. I just think three-dimensionally. I always try to feel instinctively deep inside me what the scene is requiring, if it's in the range of instruments, something low, something high, something really wide, should I wait for the strings to come in, do we need depth of field, in the orchestra to create more depth of field visually, you know, to have the sensation that the screen is getting deeper or wider, or it's something very physical, funnily enough. It's not just intellectual. There's something very physical about it when you think about the music. And of course, we're talking about not only the action scenes, but also the more intimate scenes, which I try to tailor very specifically and very carefully.
Yeah, yeah. I know you might be slightly embarrassed by this analogy, but I mean, this is very much a Mahler symphony in the sense that it goes from the most rarefied chamber music to these big, hairy, scary things. But I think for the most part, you know, it's this magical somewhere in the middle. And the hardest thing to do is, well, the hardest thing in anything, the hardest thing in any dramatic scene is to get somebody from point A to point B and go through a door. I mean, this is the toughest thing. The most deceptively simple seeming things are really the toughest.
It's true that a movie like this one is offering you a huge canvas from, as you say, a huge dramatic, epic, operatic orchestration to a very intimate, quiet moment, like when the kids are on the viaduct at the end. I chose to make silence, you know, to make pauses between the chords. I felt that moment, silent was more important than a flow of notes. So it's a great opportunity for a composer to be able to play with that and have this incredible tool, this huge orchestra, the wonderful London Symphony with 100 and more players and the London Voices, 80-piece choir, and so many other elements that you can bring in because you have the resources and also you have the images to match. Yes, it's an incredible adventure.
You were telling me you're about to do something you haven't done in a while. You're going to actually take a vacation.
Yes. Oh, yes. It's about time because I've been really working nonstop for many, many years. And since I started working on American movies, not only I've been doing American movies, but I've been still working on French movies and British movies and traveling a lot and, you know, being bicontinental, almost three continental because England is an island, even though now we have the train to go through. And yes, and I need to make a little break, well-deserved after so many years. But I'm recording next week in London, so the break is to come, yes, in August. August will be a kind of retreat for me at last.
Yes. How very French. I mean, the entire city of Paris takes off in
absolutely
August.
You're right. But it, you know, it's the summer over there, so
oh, yeah, sure.
And it's the moment where you can go by the beach, and so it's, here you can go to the beach the whole year long. Yeah. It's different.
Yeah. How much time did you have on part two? It's a huge score. I mean, just not only in physical terms, but just in terms of length. You know, it's...
I think altogether, writing and recording, it took about 4 months, which was just enough, I think. But I wish I could write faster. I feel at times that I write very slowly, but I can improve, I'm sure.
Well, I don't really think there's any pattern, and I don't think there's anything to be said for music should be written in this amount of time. I mean, it just tends to take as much time as it takes. I mean, to say something intuitively obvious.
Yes, if you want to, of course, if you want to detail and to really have an eye on every piece of the orchestration, well, you have to take more time, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of ear does the director, David Yates, have? I mean, what kind of in spotting sessions, for instance, how specific did he get as to what he thought he needed? Or is he one of those guys who just says, you know, you're the composer, do your job?
No, it's a mix of both. He has a great sense of how the emotion should be playing, and he's very character-driven. He likes his characters. He likes his actors. He comes from a school of a more intimate cinema, and therefore he focuses a lot on that, and it's more important for him that I follow the scene through the dramaturgy than through the action. And you will notice that in many scenes in the film, I've chosen to not really follow the action to the step, you know, and Mickey Mouse some scenes, but on the contrary, try to create an overall feel. And sometimes, like in a, I often think about how John Barry would do in some of the James Bonds, where there's a lot of action and the music is not fast. The music is rather slow, actually, and lyrical. And that's more a direction that we took with David, because he likes this kind of counterpoint also.
Yeah. There were some scenes I thought it was incredibly brave and daring to have no music at all. And of course, the composer, you know, there are some composers who think there should be music straight through because music is the only thing that can really save this turkey. But do you know what I mean? You know,
Yes, yeah, but again, his world of cinema is more European, and on that respect, the use of music is less, much, much less. We tend to think that less is more. Our culture of music in cinema, if you go back to, you know, the 60s, Georges Delerue and Maurice Jarre and Michel Legrand, it's almost never wall-to-wall. I can't even think of one film that has wall-to-wall music in the French cinema.
I can think of one. Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Yes, there you cheat.
Yeah,
of course, the Michel Legrand's musicals, of course. But if you think of Summer 42, which is Michel Legrand, it's not wall-to-wall.
No, there you go.
The music only comes when it's really bringing something else, you know, it's really crucial that it's there. It's almost, but don't forget that it's more of a literary culture, both the Brits and the French. So I think David's inspiration is more on that side.
Yeah. I had this feeling just watching this thing that there was never an opportunity that was wasted, and there was never, you know, the sense that, well, we really need to do something here, so let's do it. And it was very, it's kind of hard to sound silly saying it about a 70-minute score, but it's very sparing.
Funnily enough, yes, it is. It's true. But also the way that I scored and the way we orchestrated, trying not to be always bombastic, because music can be there and still be very respectful of the dialogues and the sounds and be forgotten, you know, and so you don't feel like it's wall-to-wall. It's not pushing you all the time to amplify every single emotion or every single line of dialogue. So I think also it balances. It can be still 70 minutes, but you don't feel that it's so overdoing it.
No, not at all. Music from Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, the very last of the Harry Potter movies, and it went out in style, I think it's fair to say. If the box office I don't know what box office, Billy Wilder said a very interesting thing. He said, people individually may be dumb, but as an audience, they're a genius. You know, and that's almost always the case.
No, it's true. It's funny, when I went for the first time to a panel, you know, after a focus group, after a screening of a film here in Los Angeles, I never seen that before, because we don't do that in Europe. And I was actually rather baffled by the things that I heard, because some of them was really accurate. And as a group, you can feel if they liked, disliked, were engaged, were moved. And yes, there's some kind of a truth at some point about the overall amount of people that go see a film.
Yeah. The reaction to this one has been pretty much uniformly one way. I mean, I haven't really heard or read anything other than, boy, if you have to end it, this is the way it should have ended.
Yeah, don't forget, there's also a great producer, David Heyman, the producer who invented these films. Now, of course, with the other David Baron, they really are very smart men and very smart producers. They've always tried to bring each film to a level of excellence that's very special.
Absolutely. That is composer Alexander Desplat. He's my guest tonight here on 91.5 Classical KUSC Los Angeles, the member-supported broadcast service of the University of Southern California. Of course, that's not the only project that you've been busy with in the last few months. I mean, it's just, I just, thinking of your schedule, I mean, it's just really daunting. I mean, I don't quite know how you do it.
Well, the issue is that when I did part one, I was not yet hired to do part two. I was not even meant to do it. So I had scheduled French and British movies in the gap that I had. That became a gap. It was not a gap at the time. It was just my next movies. And so when I entered part one, I was committed to do three movies, which I did. And then I was asked to do part two. So unfortunately, I had to jump again into work immediately after this third project. And I wish I wish I knew I would have taken less work, you know. But then I was committed, and I just had to do what I had to do, and less, you know, sleep less and work more. That's the way it is.
Well, I mean, that's what composers have done for a long time. I mean, Bach had to do a cantata a week, period. No matter what.
Yeah, and Mozart had to deliver at the time, and Haydn, and I know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Only Debussy took his time.
He did, because he could.
Yeah.
And there's a new Roman Polanski.
Yeah, that's done. Yes, I've completed that a while ago. He shot a version, a film version of a play by Yasmina Reza, who was shown here and in New York, quite a big successful play called The Gods of Carnage that he adapted for the screen, with a great cast: Kate Winslet, Jodie Foster, J.C. Reilly, and Christoph Waltz. Incredible direction, of course, by Roman, who's, as we all know, he's a genius. I'm glad. I hope this one will be more seen than The Ghostwriter, which was a bit forgotten last year for some weird reason, because The Ghostwriter was certainly the best movie he had shot for the last 10 years, since The Pianist, I would say. You know, it's a bit like The Rope, Hitchcock, The Rope, because it's all in one set for the whole film. And Roman asked me to write the opening and the end titles. There was no room for any score inside the film. It would have sounded like a wall-to-wall movie, you know, music for a movie. We tried to find the violence and the wit that the play has. We had fun. It was good to be in a studio with him, because on the last one we couldn't be together at the recordings. If you remember, he was held up in Switzerland, unfortunately.
Yeah. And there's a new George Clooney.
Yes, we're working on that right now. I'm here in LA to work with George. He directed a fantastic political thriller. There again, with a cast which is amazing. He plays the governor, and there's Ryan Gosling, Paul Giamatti, Philip Seymour Hoffman, even Rachel Wood. So it's a wonderful cast and a great film. I'm really happy to do that.
Yeah. Well, listen, take August and enjoy it.
And keep it. I'll take August and keep it as long as I can. Yeah, it will be good to be be near my friends and family and you know, be resting. I'm not going to be resting, of course. I've got things to write, I'll be kind of resting. Yeah. I need to prepare more for this quintet that I write all the time for, and find new ideas and new transcriptions, and so there's I'll be busy. I'll be busy resting.
Yes. Yeah, I don't want to say that the score saves the best for last, but you know, one of the great lump in the throat movements, you know, the final scene of this picture, and the music just, I'm not going to say I actually lost it at the screening, but I did. And, you know, I'm not that deeply invested in Harry Potter. I mean, I have to tell you, I mean, it's a charming series and stuff, but my emotional connection with it has not always been, you know, as intense as it is with other things. And it just really did it. And I think the music really did it at the end.
Mm.
I mean, in a way that only music can, really.
Thank you.
Yeah. So see you some other time, and you be well rested. And
so I can go back to work even more.
And bring some quintet stuff. I mean, there's some really exciting chamber things going on in France these days. The Eben Quartet, for instance.
Yeah.
These four certifiable madmen that I think are about as exciting as anybody in the world today.
Yeah, thank you for playing the Rosamunda this morning.
Oh, okay.
In my car. I was Schuberting as I was driving here.
Yeah, one of his numerous bomb theatrical projects. I mean, it ran to one performance. And, you know, the rumor has it, it could have actually closed in the middle of that first performance. Mm. Dreadful play.
Mm.
What great music.
Mm.
Not the first time a composer has spent a lot of time on something that wasn't worthy of him. Alexander Desplat, come back soon.
I will.